All right, let's start with the trial of animals in Europe. And I'd like to open by describing the aftermath of one of those trials. It's a picture reproduced in the best book on this topic, which is called The Criminal Prosecution of Animals. It's a book that's almost a century old now. And it's a great picture. It shows the aftermath of one of these trials. It's a wonderful illustration. It's entitled The Execution of a Sow. The Execution of a Sow. A sow is, of course, a female pig. It captures the full seriousness of the event. For this pig is to be hung to death. This is no lynching. This is a legal execution clearly ordered by the court. It takes place before a full crowd of people. There are high and low ranked men and women and lots of children. There are even two hounds in the crowd accompanying people. But significantly, and I'll come back to this, no other pigs in sight. The pig is dressed in a cape, and the authorities are there on the scaffold being a raised platform for executions to take place on. And there's a figure in horseback near the scaffold representing the local authority. There is a priest pronouncing the last rites over the pig about to die, and there is a state executioner who's about to do the deed. In other words, this human society pictured in this illustration, execution of a sow, has taken this pig's crime and guilt very seriously. Almost all European societies from the ancient Greeks into the 19th century put animals and insects on trial. And they proceeded against these other living creatures through basically three grounds. First, for a specific criminal act, such as maiming or killing. Second, three big categories of why animals are on trial: involvements in evil acts or magic. Evil acts of magic. Animals involved in magic could be tried, just as witches could be tried. Third, as pests who destroyed the food supply or bothered human society in some way. In each of these big categories, the proceedings make some sort of social sense. Let me illustrate these points a little fuller with some examples, mixing in some explanations as I go around, along, and then turning to the nature and the meaning of these trials in full. Take the example of a criminal act by an animal. Now, this illustration was perfect because the animal most commonly accused of a criminal act and was a pig accused of killing and eating a small child. Other domestic animals, oxen, horses, bulls, cows, appear more rarely in the records accused of killing a small child. Only dogs come next to pigs in high numbers in the records. And indeed, this fact reflects a basic fact of European animal husbandry, and that is pigs and dogs ran loose. They ran loose in the streets and the fields. They foraged for their own food daily. And if they came upon an unattended child, especially an infant, say out in a cradle getting some sun, they routinely killed and ate said child. Hence, a typical trial would be held against a pig or dog who committed such an act. For instance, a judge of Savigny in 1457 condemned to death an infanticidal sow, a female pig, who had killed and eaten a child. A month later in 1457, this same judge tried and condemned her piglets. Six piglets of the said sow were tried and convicted for complicity in her crime and ordered to be confiscated. They benefited from her crime by suckling with their mother, and they were, like their mother, convicted and destroyed, and their flesh was not eaten. they were considered unclean, taboo. And this points to a key motivation for these trials. Christian medieval society, the society of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, believed that a killing, unless properly expiated, unless properly dealt with by the society, would arouse demons who could then use this rift in the social order to take possession of people, of things, or beings like cows and pigs. Or if a killing, a death, was not dealt with properly, God would be angry and would punish the society. Okay, so killing a child and suffering the death penalty for it is a crime we recognize, even if we don't have pigs wandering outside the windows today, and even if we don't put animals on trial for killing children. But animals were also proceeded against things that you probably would not think of as crimes, at least by the animal. For instance, the penalty for bestiality, a human being having sex with an animal, for both parties was death. The penalties for these acts, sexual contact with animals, which, by the way, happened quite commonly in the European past, they're in all the records, they're everywhere in the old legal records. The penalties for these acts stem from the Mosaic law recorded in Exodus and Leviticus, which prescribed sexual contact with beasts and set a punishment of death. It is these same chapters in the Old Testament that also, interestingly enough, form the basis of European anti-witchcraft laws. And in fact, the prosecution of bestiality cases and witchcraft cases pretty much coincides as an arc going up and down in European history. So there's a connection there. And the connection is even stronger when you remember that these animals, when killed, were not eaten. They were taboo. Because the peak of this prosecution of bestiality cases comes in the 15th and 16th century, during the height of the European witch craze, commentators say that the animals have been possessed by the devil, and they are instigating the action. They are not innocent victims, they are evil seducers. There's a real fear of magic and the supernatural at play here. Indeed, the same fear is reflected at the same time in the European societies looking at monster births. You know, babies that come out deformed, or animals that come out differently than expected. The European society, the peasant society, and the upper societies would react with great alarm. For instance, in 1474, the magistrates of Valais, which is in Switzerland now, sentenced a rooster to be burned at the stake for the heinous and unnatural crime of laying an egg. A rooster that laid an egg was considered dangerous, a criminal act, because the egg was presumed to be an act of magic. It was common thought that such an egg were particularly an active ingredient for witchcraft, and the hatchling from such an egg was the, in myth anyway, the evil cockatrice. A cockatrice was a being that descended from the roosters and chickens, and whose very look could kill, could blight your home and your farm. There is one other type of proceeding in this period of European criminal punishment of animals. And that is when whole hosts of animals are brought to law. The list of animals and insects proceeded against includes caterpillars, flies, fleas, termites, locusts, grasshoppers, weevils, beetles, moles, mice, rats, snails, vermin, pests, animals that descend in great numbers on a community and start literally eating its foundations, its crops. Faced with such a pestilence, village, town, and city all turned to church courts, to ecclesiastical courts, to the courts, typically of the Catholic Church, later on in some jurisdictions, some Protestant churches. And the church court's ruling typically ordered these animals out of the orchards, vineyards, and fields, ordered them away from towns under the threat of excommunication. And typically what they would do is they would hold a court trial and they would get some mice to represent all mice and they would put them in the dock. You know, they put them in a little cage in front of everybody else, or, you know, a few mice, a few rats, a weevils, whatever, and they would go to court to stand in for their brothers and sisters during the proceedings. Well, I mean, what do you want to make of this? I mean, this, you know, I mean, hanging a pig seems fairly normal compared to this. Now consider this, though. This is before modern poisons, pesticides. An easy winter where the mice population grows and grows and grows. This was a disaster of epic proportions. These animals are not under human domination, they're under God's domination. We turn to the church courts to deal with them. In the case of ecclesiastical courts, and in the case of criminal acts by animals, including bestiality and magic, the accused were granted full trials. These trials were never pro forma little proceedings, but full-scale trials. The animals got due process of law as it existed in their societies. They were speechless. Pigs don't talk, mice don't talk, weevils don't talk, so they had appointed counsel. And their counsel took the task quite seriously. I want to give you the example of one notable example. This is the French jurist Bartholomew Chassenin, who represented some rats put on trial before the ecclesiastical court of Autun for having eaten the barley crop. Now Chassenin, yeah, I mean, he's faced with a problem. His clients are, they're guilty. They're notoriously guilty. And so he employs all of his considerable skills to find a loophole through which the rats can escape. He urged at first, you know, he's appointed, and he said, whoa, stop the proceedings here. My defendants are dispersed over the countryside, and you've only had one proclamation to come and bring them to court. We must have more proclamations so they all know of their legal peril. And indeed, he succeeded in obtaining a second public citation to be proclaimed from all the parish churches saying to the rats, you must come to court. The rats still don't show up. Oh, come on, rats don't read. The rats don't show up. And Chassenin pleaded their non-appearance. And he pleaded a very good legal point. He said, look, the rats aren't here because it's too perilous for them to come. The vigilance of the cats who wait for them behind every corner has kept them from court. Now, this is a very good point of law. If a person cited to appear at the place could not come safely, he didn't have to come. So the rats could use the right of appeal and not obey the summons. Clearly, the lawyers took the matter with some seriousness then. I mean, sure, you may joke about, well, the cats are here, but there's seriousness here. And why? Courts take time and money. And one of our best records of this all happening is how much these animals that are being held as criminal felons, criminals waiting trial, eat in the jails. And besides that, you have lawyers, court officials, even executioners paid to deal with these animals. Why? There's got to be some social advantages. Societies don't go off on bizarre benders like this very easily, and not for centuries. Well, first, as we hinted in earlier trials, when we discussed them, trials served as rituals to guard against supernatural actions, against supernatural evils, be they swarms of locusts, pigs infested with demons. It was, as I said before, the equivalent of the public putting on a charm to protect itself. But there is also deterrence. Law is often used to try to deter actions it doesn't want taken. Now, let's go back to that execution of the South picture and remember who is there. People are there. Now, when I say deterrence, I'm not saying that they're putting pigs and dogs on trial for killing and eating babies because they want to deter pigs and dogs. This solution would only make sense if pigs and dogs were paraded before the execution, which they were not. You know, they're going to watch the moral lesson of the scaffold. That's not who watches the moral lesson of the scaffold. It was people. The deterrence is aimed at people. The taking of these cases into court, the use of the full seriousness of the law in which they were treated in court, shows to the people that the court and the civil authorities dealt with all crimes, all problems. This is an attempt, these trials of animals, to assure the population that they could get justice at law. It's an advertisement for law. The civil authorities that are using these trials are saying, use law, not your own hands to get justice. In almost every European society, law follows traditions of vengeance and blood feud. Problems were solved by personal vengeance and family blood feud. In societies where vengeance and blood feud had served to solve disputes for generations, where law came later, these trials were wonderful advertisements for law. What they're telling Europeans is, oh, your neighbor's pig killed and ate your child. Well, don't go and burn down your neighbor's house because of it. Go to law, have the pig proceeded against. As you examine European records of violent crime, especially destruction of property, battery, and killings, it's clear that it's really apparent that the cause of many of these crimes was the desire to take vengeance, was the late appeal of the blood feud. And so trials were public and for everything to forestall such acts, to preserve social order. They functioned as advertisements for law. They were serious social theater. That's why the executioner is used. That's why the priest is there. That's why the symbols of authority are there. That's why it's held on the scaffold. It's public. They're sending a message. The law functions and functions well. And what makes it really clear that this is what they're doing is there are acquittals and pardons occasionally. In exceptional circumstances, or where the evidence isn't good, there are acquittals or pardons for animals that did something but still had a reason for doing it. The law showed itself to take all crimes seriously, thus deterring private justice and vengeance. Thus, when we glance at the society that held these trials and understand their view of magic and the supernatural, understand how much they need law to preserve social order, these bizarre trials, weevils on trials, pigs on trials dressed in a cape, make sense. And remember, they are public trials. They are public forums. They are sending a public message, advertisement of the social value of the law. This is a function we're going to see in a lot of trials, a function that we will see worked out in numerous examples, indeed in our next example, a case of murder, I've already prejudged them, haven't I? A case of homicide, that is the killing of a human being, and cannibalism, the eating of a human being on the high seas. And this case grew out of government officials' desires to set and express social values through a courtroom trial. All right, so get medieval Europe out of your mind now and move forward to the 19th century. Put yourself in the British Empire. And let's talk first about seaborne commerce. The world by the 17th century has been tied together by seaborne ships that get their power by holding sails to the wind and going with the winds. When a ship sank in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, usually some survivors escaped in smaller boats. Almost without exceptions, these people were in a very bad state. First of all, they existed without means of communications to call rescuers. They're away from land, they're in the high ocean, and there's no such thing as radio. They have no real means of powering themselves to be rescued. Rowing is difficult to row across the Atlantic, any serious distance. They can sail. And of course, they're in a small ship. They have sails, they have oars, they're cast adrift usually, and they mostly depended on luck and skill to bring them where they could be rescued or to land. And to complicate their lives and their deaths, the people who escaped a shipwreck usually didn't have sufficient food or water. That is, most lifeboats were short of both. In this period, from the 17th to the 19th century, from 1600 to about 1890 even, it was generally believed that seawater was unsafe to drink. Thus, people in lifeboats often died of thirst, then starvation. But wait, there was a way to guarantee the survival of some. There was a way to avoid death by thirst and starvation. If you killed one of your boatmates and immediately, I want to stress this, immediately drank the blood and ate the flesh, the others would survive. Now this is I want to really just stress, this is really, really nasty. I mean, you're killing someone so you live. It's a brutal solution. By the way, if any of you find yourself on a lifeboat, do not resort to this. First of all, I want to assure you that actually you can drink seawater. You don't need to drink other human beings' blood to survive. If you start drinking seawater in small amounts mixed with urine, you're guaranteed not to dehydrate, but you have to start right away. You don't wait to think, oh God, I'll get over the disgust of this soon. Mm-mm. You have to start right away on a new regimen, a new diet, to keep yourself hydrated so you don't die of dehydration. People of this period from the 17th to the 19th century just didn't know this. And they resorted to the brutal solution of cannibalism. This was I can't overemphasize this, the common solution among survivors of shipwrecks in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. Excuse me. It was called the custom of the sea. Indeed, there are even social customs of how you choose the victim. Certain way of choosing the victim and a certain way of treating the dead body of the victim. First of all, typically, supposedly, you drew lots with the person getting the short straw, stick, whatever, being the victim, and the person getting the next shortest straw, stick, whatever, being the executioner. I mean, imagine how that person feels. He pulls out the shortest stick first, and then the next thing he gets is one that sees somebody else get one shorter. Well, he feels very good. He's not going to die that day. Almost invariably, the head of the victim is cut off and thrown overseas, thrown overboard. And the reason that this is done is to make the corpse less human, to make it, you know, liquid and flesh to eat. The blood was drained from the still warm corpse and drunk. And it has to be drunk right away, otherwise it's going to clot, be useless for the purposes you want it to be. The body was butchered and the flesh and organs eaten fresh or stored for later use. Such killing and cannibalism was a brutal necessity, and the men and women who resorted to it were not treated as criminals upon their rescue or their landing. Sea songs, the ballads and shanties of sailors, show the nature of the custom. Take one from the late 18th century, the shipwreck of the Essex. After a wreck, the survivors run out of food and water, quoting the ballad now. Quote, "Then lots were drawn. One man was to die, for his wife and poor children most bitterly did cry. To kill him, says the captain, or to take away his breath, but to starve with hunger is a deplorable death. Then his messmates, they killed him and cut off his head, and all the ship's crew from the body did feed." Now, in this particular lifeboat, 8 more times after the first guy was killed did they resort to cannibalism. Now, everybody thought this was horrible, disgusting, and one of the dangers of making your living on the sea. The Ballad of the Essex concludes, "God bless all poor seamen, their children and wives, in trying to get their bread, how they venture their lives. So now to conclude, what I've mentioned is right. God protect all seamen by day, by night." Now, note, there's no blame put on the captain and the messmates. God isn't asked to punish them. God is asked to protect all. Now, what's really interesting about the custom of the sea is it's a fiction. This lot drawing stuff, the first time I heard it, I went, I don't believe it. And then I started reading more about it. And guess what? The scholars have gone back and looked at it and noticed that almost always it's the odd man out who suffers first. That is to say, a German on a ship of Scandinavians, well, you can guess who's going to be the first one killed and eaten. The German guy. A passenger amongst sailors. The outsider is the first one to go. Then, the list goes down. The weakest, the ill, a woman, a cabin boy was a likely victim. Never was the authority of a ship the first victim. The captain or the mate was never the first one killed. Thus, the killing and eating order seemed to follow the path of least resistance. And it is a pretty good inference that the lock picking was rigged, and rigged against somebody with the contrivance of at least one or two people in the boat. And it was used to insulate the community of the sea from this rational but brutal expedient of how you survive when you're shipwrecked. I cannot overemphasize how well known this killing and cannibalism was in the sailors' communities. It was known, it was there, and it was not punished. Moreover, the people who engaged in it were not treated as pariahs. No one refused to ship out with them later after they returned home safely. They would cheerfully sail with these people again. They weren't sanctioned. This is how the custom of the seas existed until about the middle of the 19th century. But in the middle of the 19th century, the knowledge of the custom of the sea grows. It grows because the societies change. In the 19th century, you have the spread of newspapers, the rise of cheap steam printing, which gives you the penny press, which means papers can be distributed widely. They're inexpensive. The penny press is followed by telegraph, which communicate news even faster, and the knowledge of the awful acts spread beyond the maritime communities to the societies at large. And in England, finally we square back to where I said we were going to go, and in England, one of the most seafaring of nations, the spread of the news of the custom of the sea became news. Britain had an overseas empire, it had some of the most advanced press of the day, and it had the constant media maw to be fed with stories, and the people in England, particularly those readers of the penny press and the daily papers, loved sensation stories, and let's be serious, shipwrecks and cannibalism are wonderful sensation stories. Cannibalism was good copy, and the custom of the sea became widely known in the British public. It went beyond the shipping communities in the port towns to become common knowledge, and it caught the eye of government officials in the 1860s and 70s. In 1884, they got a case. They got a case when the yacht Miganet, and this is how it was said in England, it's probably, if you know you're French, it's not said Miganet, captained by Thomas Dudley with Edwin Stevens, mate, and Ned Brooks as a sailor, and little Richard Parker, 19, as cabin boy, they set off from Falmouth, England, to Sydney, Australia, sailing a racing yacht to be delivered in Sydney. They're sailing outside, I mean, this is just a racing yacht, so they're sailing outside of the regular steamship and sailship channels to avoid being run down by bigger boats. Far from land, outside the regular shipping routes, they run into a terrible storm, and the ship began to sink. The whole crew escaped into a small dinghy, with Captain Dudley showing heroic bravery. There is no doubt about it. Dudley is one of these guys. I mean, the ship is going down. He is going under the water, pulling stuff out of the boat to throw in the dinghy. He's heroic, his aim is not too good, the water cast, the most important thing, misses and sinks, but he tried. The tin of turnips arrives safely, as does a lot of other stuff. And they retrieve enough equipment, food, tins of turnips, and the boat goes down. Now these four guys were adrift, well not all four of them, these guys were adrift for 24 days in an open boat with no water other than the rainwater they caught in the sail and the blood of one small sea turtle who ventured too close to their little boat. They were starving. They were perishing of thirst. 18 days in, Richard Parker drank seawater, became ill with diarrhea, and started going delirious and comatose. All of them thought they were doomed. They knew their circumstances. Help wasn't on the horizon anywhere. Wasn't likely to be. They didn't have a functioning sail that worked very well. And at this point, after Parker drank seawater, they began to consider cannibalism. They did not draw lots. When someone proposes, this was the first proposal, I suggest we go to the custom of the sea, someone else said, and it's all very, each one of the three survivors tells a different story, and they tell different versions, and it's hard to figure out what the hell really happened. But someone else said, we had better die together. Captain Dudley argued for cannibalism. He said, it's hard for four to die when perhaps one might save the rest. That's pretty clear. Later, Dudley said to Stevens, what is to be done? I believe the boy, remember he's comatose now, is dying. You have a wife and five children. I have a wife and three children. Human flesh has been eaten before. Interestingly enough, Brooks, a bachelor, took no part of this particular conversation. And indeed, the implications to him are pretty damn bad because, oh, well, we finished off Richard Parker and we're still dying of hunger and thirst. Who's next? The next day, apparently, it was decided amongst the three to kill the boy. Brooks later claimed that they drew lots rigged against the boy. In any case, Dudley, after offering up a prayer of forgiveness to God, cut Parker's throat while Stevens held his legs. All three men drank the fresh blood. All three ate the butchered flesh. They all participated in cutting the flesh into strips and hanging it here and there on the boat to dry, and the flesh sustained them for 5 more days before their rescue. They were rescued by a German vessel, and when rescued, some of Parker's body parts are still hanging around, though Brooks apparently throws most of it overboard at the last instance. Now, these men, Stevens, Brooks, and Dudley, they are in bad shape. I mean, you cannot understand how bad they are. They are rotten with sores and ulcers. They are weak. They have survived the worst kind of ordeal, and they are not hiding what they've done. Dudley was frank in telling all, admitting that he had done the deed. I killed the boy with this knife. I did it right there on the back of the boat. In fact, the dinghy is pulled up out of the water and put on the German boat and taken off with them. As they were coming to England, Dudley told the whole tale to a British pilot. Now, you know, when a ship comes into a port, a government official, a pilot, comes on board, and the pilot's job is to steer them into the port, but also to say, are there any incidences of voyages that have to be reported for law? And Dudley says, yeah, my boat went down and we had to kill and eat Richard Parker. And he says, oh, well, you're going to have to see the collector of customs when you land. And so Dudley is taken. He can't walk. He has to be carried. He's taken to the collector's office and he tells the story. And outside the office, because a rumor has already circulated in the town that this has happened, outside the office is a police sergeant who's taking notes as to what Dudley says. He's the guy who's going to start the prosecution's ball rolling. Now, as one press account puts it, Dudley did not confess to crime, but he told his story, quote, with the straightforward truthfulness which a sailor usually describes any noteworthy incident of a voyage. He had apparently no idea whatsoever he was liable to any legal proceedings, and when arrested, expressed nothing but astonishment. Officials in London, they land in Falmouth, England, by the way, where they came out of. Officials in London are contacted, and the leading law officers of the British Empire and the government discuss the case. Government officials wanted the case to move forward to establish a rule of law. As one official wrote, quote, the Miganet people ought to be properly prosecuted. They certainly ought to be convicted, for if the principle of these proceedings be admitted as correct and justifiable, I shall decline for the future to sit near any man with a large appetite. End of quote. The same official says, prosecute them to the full extent of the law, concludes his letter urging prosecution with this sentence or phrase, when convicted, you can let them off. End of quote. In other words, they want the principle established. They may not want the men hung. Interestingly enough, while the government says prosecute, the public in Falmouth is on their side. Before the magistrates' court, when they were arraigned for trial, the public applauded the decision that gave the men bail. The only thing that apparently worried the Falmouth public was the lack of casting of lots. When a rumor circulated that they did, well, and maybe they did actually propose drawing lots and they never did it, when it came out that they proposed drawing lots, they were hailed as heroes. And anonymous and public donations for their defense were forthcoming. Money was given to support them. while they recovered and could not work. Remember, these men, except for Brooks, are in really bad shape. Both Dudley and Stevens will have to be carried into court. Brooks is the strongest of the lot. He recovers quickly. As the details spread in the press, Dudley, Stevens, and Brooks, they speak to the press. Public opinion makes them heroes. Not even Richard Parker's relatives, not his mother, father, sisters, or brothers, called for punishment of these men. That does not stop government officials. They want to use the case to establish the principle in law that necessity cannot excuse homicide. It's interesting, those pressing for the prosecution assume, when they're found guilty, that these men will only suffer a nominal punishment, that a pardon would soon follow. On the other hand, on the other side, Dudley and Stevens and his companions, they couldn't even figure out why they're being prosecuted. Thomas Dudley writes to the newspapers saying, "I don't understand why you would want to prosecute me. This wasn't murder. Murder requires premeditation and malice. There was no malice here." But the government plan ground on. The prosecutor turned, when you got to prosecute somebody, you got three people there, you got to get one of them to testify. The prosecutor made a deal with Brooks. Turned Brooks into a prosecution witness, discharging him from further process. So Stevens and Dudley were arraigned before magistrates and bound over for trial at the next meeting of the traveling court, the Exeter Assizes. The case was heard before a jury and a judge. Just to confuse you, the judge is, his technical title is Baron of the Exchequer. John Huddleston. Now, Huddleston wants to make a statement of law. He's got two problems, first of all. He doesn't just want to have the case come out of a little court of the Exeter Assizes meeting on circuit. He wants it to come from a court with lots of judges. There's only him on the court, one. Two, he looks around the place where the jury's going to come from, Falmouth, and thinks, "Oh, no. They're not going to convict. I have to keep this case from collapsing so we can have a chance to have a statement of law. We don't want Dudley and Stevens acquitted." Now, Huddleston, who the best author on this case calls the devious Baron Huddleston, was more than equal to this challenge of you got to get to a higher court somehow and you got to keep it from collapsing. And so the first thing he does, trial opens, and the defense gets up and starts talking about necessity, and Huddleston interrupts them and said, "Excuse me, necessity is no defense in English common law. You won't be arguing that anymore." So much for the defense's main point. The baron has just jerked it away from him and said, you can't put it as a position of law. I won't listen to it. Now, the defense could argue it to the jury and do, but the judge can then turn around and does and did say, "It's not law. Don't listen to him." So, having then first emasculated the defense, the trial carries on. The prosecution calls its witnesses, including Brooks, who tells the tale. The defense calls no one. Now, let me explain. The defense can't call Dudley and Stevens because they're accused of a felony. And until 1898 in England, anyone accused of felony could not testify under oath. It was presumed that you would commit perjury. You would be so tempted to lie, you would lie automatically, and therefore you couldn't testify under oath in England's court, so you're accused of crime, but you can't talk about it. So what his lawyers do, the defense does, is raise legal points. What else can they do? They raise some very nice legal questions, like the best one. Does this court have jurisdiction? Where exactly did this crime be? Was it committed? Was it committed on the high seas? Why are we listening to this crime? It urged also a general verdict by the jury. Acquit. Acquit. Huddleston did not trust the jury. He heard the pleas by the defense for acquittal. He looked at the jury men, and they were all men in this period, and he thought, I don't trust them. And at the conclusion of the evidence phase of the trial and the argument phase, the Baron Huddleston suggested to the jury that they issue a special verdict. Now let me back up a little bit and explain. I told you about a general verdict before, and usually a jury usually finds innocent or guilty. Verdict. That's it, usually. Up until the 17th century in England, and until the early 20th century in the United States, there was another option: special verdicts. Now notice I said up to the 17th century, 1600s. Here it is the 19th century, Huddleston has pored back over the law books and said, special verdict might fit it. And basically a special verdict is this: the jury finds whether someone has done the deed, but then says, we're not sure that's illegal under the law. The jury returns a verdict, guilty if the law is this. The implication being, if the law isn't that, the people walk. This is a special verdict. Huddleston gives this idea to the jury, says, you can do a special verdict. And in fact had drafted a sample special verdict for them. And it was crafted to appeal to a jury leaning towards acquittal. And Huddleston had read these jurors correctly. If they weren't given this special verdict stuff, they would have probably acquitted. First of all, Huddleston summed up the facts of the case, pointing out, pounding on this fact, as you would expect a Falmouth jury to be worried about, that lots weren't drawn. The custom wasn't followed exclusively. Secondly, Huddleston, the devious man that he was, neglected to tell them that they could have brought in a general verdict of innocent. He presented it as guilty or special verdict. Oh, is he smart or what? So of course, they seize special verdict. The jury accepted his special verdict with a, you'll love this, with a plea for mercy. Wait a second, a plea for mercy? You know, they haven't even been convicted yet. How can you plea for mercy? Because they just said, well, they did the killing, but we don't know if it's a crime. The law courts will determine if it's a crime. But give them mercy, just in case. All right. Now, you're all used to appeals courts as we have them in this country. You know, a case goes, often can go to appeal after it being tried in a trial court. In England at this period, there was no such thing as a central appeals court. What happened in the English legal system is they gathered a group of judges together to determine what the law was about cannibalism on the high seas. The court of five judges met in London without a jury. And they listened to the defense argue that necessity kept this from being a homicide. The question of necessity was batted about quite a bit. It's a lawyer's question now. The defense got to argue that men in a dinghy had been cast into a state of nature and necessity had to be followed. All legal obligations were dissolved in this state of nature. The defense, being good lawyers, didn't just ride it all on necessity. They also pleaded very cogently and carefully mitigation. The standard argument in mitigation: human beings are frail. Under stress, they do bad things, not with evil intent. The five judges of this panel unanimously rejected the defense's arguments. Without listening to the state's attorney, who was there, sitting there, waiting to talk, and the judge said, "We've heard enough," retired to a back room for about 5 minutes, and came back with a verdict saying it upheld the judgment of the trial court. Now, that's not clear what the hell they mean. I mean, quite honestly, what judgment had they made? They made a special verdict. Well, then they make it very clear. They found him guilty and they condemned him to death. The reasoning of the court, as it wrote it down, was like Victorian poetry. It's a mixture of high moralism and muddle-headedness. I quote it now. Quote, "To preserve one life is, generally speaking, a duty, but it may be the plainest and highest duty to sacrifice it. War is full of instances in which it is a man's duty not to live, but to die. The duty in the case of shipwreck, of a captain to his crew, of a crew to the passengers, of soldiers to women and children, these duties imposed on men and the moral necessity, not of preservation, but the sacrifice of their lives for others, from which in no country, least of all it is hoped in England, will men ever shrink, as indeed they have not shrunk," period, end thundering quotation. Now, what does this mean? It means duty to a rigid law of morality does not allow for necessity to bend the rules. The law is clearly stated. No killing could be justified under these circumstances. We don't care if you're cast adrift and the only way you can survive is to kill and eat each other. That is homicide. The court's opinion presented the seafaring community with the command in the situation, you're on the high ocean, you're in a small boat, and you're going to die. Don't do anything and die. It's your duty to do so. Now, this is where we see how media functions in trials. Because what happens next is the press rallies around the high court's decision, the judge's decision. They think, by God, that was the right decision. The trial disseminated widely the knowledge that there was no casting of lots. Instead, the weakest man had been killed and eaten. It had an effect on public attitudes. Dudley and Stevens became unpopular. And because they became unpopular, the easy assumption that they would be pardoned quickly faded. Queen Victoria herself, she had a lot of trouble pardoning cannibals. She just says, I don't like this. Nevertheless, the men in the government who had wanted the prosecution to begin with wanted the sentence commuted. They didn't want to hang Dudley and Stevens. Yeah, they're murderers, but let's commute their penalty to, oh, I don't know, something generous, life in prison. They're not moral murderers, they're legal murderers. After all, we've settled the law. We've told the seafaring community what it's going to be. They press on Victoria. They press on other government officials. And finally, the pardon doesn't come, but the sentence is commuted to 6 months in prison. And the fickle English press, the fickle newspapers that hailed them as heroes, by the end of the trial said they're horrible bastards who are murderers, now loves the commuting the sentence. They see what the government lawyers had wanted them to see all along, that a statement of law can be made through a trial. Wrote one paper. The court was driven back to the elementary consideration on which all civilized systems of jurisprudence profess to be founded: protect the rights of the weak when confronted by the violence of the strong. Writes another, "It is impossible to measure the consequences if it had gone the other way. Despite the terrible suffering of Dudley and Stevens and Brooks, The depositories of power must hold fast to principles without which the earth would be indeed full of darkness and cruel habitations. Wrote yet another, "What let any system of jurisprudence accept the pleas of necessity, and society would drift back into a struggle for existence almost as brutal as that which goes on in a South American forest." The papers thought a clear message had been sent to the sailors about the practice of killing and cannibalism on the high seas. And remember, that's what this was all about. This trial came about because the government wanted to send a message. And it's important to try to figure out, did the government message get through? First of all, let's make it clear, hardly any sailors ever read law reports. So they never heard the judge's words, one, or read them. Two, hardly any sailors read newspapers. Sailors in this period were mostly illiterate. They got their news from oral sources like ballads. And most of the ballads about the Miganet case were sympathetic to the defendants. One ends after calling for pardon. They'd gone through the whole trial, they'd been convicted, calling for pardon. "We hope the brave sailors who travel by the sea may never endure suffering like these. Pity these poor men, I'm sure we all do, Captain Dudley and all the Miganet crew." Indeed, other oral traditions from Falmouth and the surrounding area said that Dudley and Stevens were prosecuted not because they killed and ate Parker, but because they didn't draw lots. The government made its absolute statement through its trial, and the sailors didn't get the message. The signal did not get through.